Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:33 p.m. on Wednesday, March 4th, 2022. And also that we have a quorum present today, our Senators Bishop, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Rivak. Staffing the committee today is my staff, Emma Torkelson, LIO moderator, Talia Ames, and Carrie Cooperrider from Records. Thank you. At this time, please silence or turn off your cell phones. Today's agenda consists of two items, a presentation from Gaffney Klein about liquefied natural gas in Alaska, and Senate Joint Resolution 24, end import of oil and gas from Russia. We're going to jump right into the presentation from Gaffney Klein. Present today are Mike Klein, Director, Corporate Strategy, Gaffney Klein, and Nick Fuller, Director, Gas and Energy Transition, Gaffney Klein. Gentlemen, please put yourselves on the record and begin when you are ready.
For the record, my name is Michael Klein, Director of Corporate Strategy with Gaffney Klein, based in London.
And for the record, my name is Nicholas Fulford. I'm Director of Gas and Energy Transition at the Houston office of Gaffney Klein.
Thank you very much. And if you could keep those microphones as close to you when you speak, we would appreciate that greatly.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let's make a start. So for me personally, the opportunity to come and speak to you today about monetizing Alaska's gas is particularly meaningful. I've spent a long time in Alaska, and I've become quite familiar with the state, not just from a gas perspective, but more generally. And so it's a real privilege to be here talking to this committee today. So I don't think anyone on this committee will kind of need reminding that there have been attempts to monetize natural gas from the North Slope for quite some years. The two concepts which have been put around, you know, one is the export of natural gas by pipeline to the lower 48. And the other concept, which has been around for quite a few years as well, is transfer of the natural gas from the North Slope, having treated it, liquefying it in the Cook Inlet and exporting it through deep water, well, either there or Valdez or some other appropriate point. Now, obviously, one of the major sort of market impacts on Alaska in the sort of 2010-11-12 timeframe was the discovery of huge amounts of unconventional natural gas in the U.S., which did two things. It eliminated what could have been a very substantial market for Alaskan LNG. And although it wasn't fully understood at the time, it's created this very significant competitive force through the Gulf Coast LNG exports, which are in themselves creating a kind of a headwind for Alaska. So obviously, Senate Bill 138 back in 2014, I think, set the tone for what is basically the current sort of concept of project. And attempts have been made since then to get a project moving, whether it's sponsored by IOCs or whether it's being pursued by state agencies. So why is it then that the gas has not yet been successfully monetized? So I'm going to start with the barriers which have hindered successful development. And of course, one of the biggest, which remains a significant hurdle, is how to liquefy and deliver that gas as efficiently as possible and in a way which will make it cost effective for buyers around the world and will also support the cost of the development. Now, clearly, a lot of work has been done over the last few years to attempt to do that. I mean, the LNG industry generally has been facing cost inflation of different sorts over the last few years. But nevertheless, the cost of the infrastructure you know, potentially some $40 billion represents a major hurdle. The other feature is the existence of competition. Qatar, for example, very low-cost producer of LNG, recently took a decision to expand their production by some 32 million tons, very significant tranche of global market. And then there are other projects like Mozambique, for example, the project in Senegal and Mauritania, and even Tanzania. That project is getting going again now after a brief respite. So these are all projects which are able to compete quite effectively and which represent competition. However, and I think I would say that the structural advantages are perhaps you know, very notable in the context of LNG projects around the world. One of them is the low-cost nature of the feedstock, where ultimately a lot of the natural gas being produced is coming off the back of some very substantial investments in oil production. And to some extent, it should be possible to leverage those investments and produce a feedstock for the plant that's very low in cost. And the other feature, which arguably has become more important even in the last few days, is that it represents, Alaska represents a potential source of gas to Pacific gas buyers. Ultimately, this is where the growth in the LNG market resides. And with the current concerns about US LNG exports from the Gulf going to Europe, this is definitely a feature. So I think with that, I'll pause for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions from the committee? Please continue.
So let's look at what's happened in the market over the last few years. First of all, it has been probably the most difficult period of time for the LNG industry in its entire history. I think you know, the key features of this were a significant structural oversupply in the, which began in the sort of 2018 period and was a direct result of very significant increases in U.S. Production from the Gulf Coast, without necessarily the demand to soak that up. That was exacerbated in the 2020 period with the COVID pandemic, which really tipped the balance even further and created not just an unsustainable investment climate for LNG, but a loss-making climate for many of the players who were already present in it. Since then, you could argue that the upward volatility in price has been almost equally a problem, because, you know, LNG is now trading at a price which makes it an unsustainable choice of fuel in the future. Now, obviously, fuel switching doesn't happen very quickly. But one of the key features of the LNG industry is the need for a stable economic environment and for the very substantial billions of dollars of investment to be made to pay for themselves over a period of decades rather than years. So this period that we've just been through, it doesn't help project developers, it doesn't help lenders. And I think the expectation would be that particularly as the LNG market becomes more fungible and there's more LNG flowing around the world able to connect different markets, that we would see a gradual stabilization and ultimately the emergence of a more sort of global price in LNG. So I think the other feature that I would mention on this page and in the terms of the global market context, of course, is the energy transition. And from I think the trigger for the LNG industry to sit up and take note, particularly for American exporters, was a decision by the French government not to approve a contract signed between a French buyer and a US Gulf Coast exporter on the basis of the carbon intensity of the gas being used. So that has sort of redoubled efforts, which already existed, I think, in certain parts of the world, to look for lower carbon ways to deliver LNG and to find a way to meet both customer requirements and investor requirements for a lower carbon project. In particular, it's been interesting that some of the major LNG producers like Shell and Total have started offering net zero cargoes to their customers. These typically involve nature-based offsets, but that in itself is not a sustainable way to address carbon. So I think we can expect to see the burden on LNG projects increasing from the perspective of delivering a lower carbon product to the customer. So again, just in terms of recent events, the US LNG exports are running at full capacity now. Most of those most of those cargoes are going to Europe, majority. And you know, this is an environment, I think, which will inevitably last for the next few months at the very least, while things in Europe remain unstable. So at that point, I will pause for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Committee questions? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am not familiar with how countries are looking at the carbon intensity of a fuel source. Are we talking about total project carbon, the steel used in the pipeline and the ships? Are we talking about what it takes to get it out of the ground and move it? What is the scope of that analysis?
Thank you, and through the chair, it's a very good question. So you can look at, well, let's look at LNG since that's the topic for today. And the production of LNG involves, you know, the upstream, producing the gas at the wellhead, transport to liquefaction, and so on and so forth. And for a typical LNG product, about 25% of the carbon emissions associated with the fuel occur during that part of the value chain, and the regas, I should say, as well. Then that leaves about 75% that is inherently involved in the burning of the fuel. So you'll see the terms scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3 applied to the entire energy value chain. And scope 1 and 2 typically relate to the direct and indirect use of energy for producing the fuel, and scope 3 is typically burning it. And in the context of those net zero LNG cargoes, it's interesting. You know, some of them focused on scope 1 and 2 only, some of them were scope 1, 2, and 3. So in the sense that, particularly in Europe, I would say, it's often the retail customer of that natural gas that you're sort of aiming at in terms of providing some sense of a carbon-free product. So the definitions around it and the way fuel is described as being net zero or carbon free is still evolving.
Just a follow up. See if I can test my understanding of what you said in hypothetical application. It would seem like Alaska North Slope Gas would have a scope one advantage because we've got a lot of established infrastructure and already discovered gas. A scope two disadvantage because there's a long pipe. And then for scope three, gas is gas. It would beat oil, but not renewables. Am I in the right zone?
I think I would redefine that in a sense, in that the scope one actually would be potentially quite high because of the compressors in the pipeline, for example, the heat exchangers in the liquefaction plant. These would be fueled directly. The scope two, for example, would be the electricity usage at the plant that might come from a power station somewhere else, which is itself producing carbon. And then the scope three is when you've delivered that natural gas to the customer. and they're burning it in their furnace or whatever.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Thank you. Other questions? Please continue.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And you know, I don't need to remind anyone on this committee, and particularly listening to your next agenda item, which is coming up. I mean, clearly, the world is in a somewhat different position compared to this time 2 weeks ago. And for the natural gas industry, this has propelled natural gas to the very forefront of the sort of geopolitical debate and discussion internationally, ultimately because of the vulnerability of Europe to imported Russian gas. So at the moment, the imports of Russian gas and payment for them is outside the sanctions that have been imposed for obvious reasons. But even so, European gas buyers have become very uneasy about the situation. And as a result, there's been a very significant ramp up in the wholesale price of natural gas in Europe. So as things stand today, the wholesale price of gas in Europe is somewhere around $60 an MMBTU, which in oil terms is around about $400 a barrel. So in thermal equivalent, and what it effectively means is that ordinary householders in, you know, Germany, Netherlands, Britain are now paying exceptionally high heating bills, and that's also reflected in electricity. So for example, the dual fuel estimate for heating costs in the UK last year was £700. Next spring, it's projected to be as high as £3,000. So you can imagine the sort of political backdrop of those sorts of cost increases being imposed on you know, residential and industrial customers in terms of damage to the economy. So so as we consider this degree of volatility and the sharp focus on gas, it immediately plays to some of those strengths that I was talking about earlier in terms of the Alaska gas position. You know, highly stable government, rule of law applies, same as the rest of the US. It's an environment that lenders and developers are accustomed to, and it represents perhaps one of the largest undeveloped sources of fuel for Asian markets. And so, you know, as we think of things today in terms of, well, what's changed for Alaska in the last few months or the last few years even, it's the effect of the events of the last couple of weeks and the fact that many strategic buyers will now be reminding themselves in terms of, okay, you know, where can we start looking for that secure, safe supply of natural gas. So obviously, you know, in terms of these major sort of geopolitical events, you know, sometimes they last a long time, sometimes less so. Certainly, I mean, I give a 6-monthly update to the State Department typically when we talk about some of these things. And I know from a US foreign policy perspective, the opportunity to extend US influence globally through this very significant resource that is now present is very much high up on their agenda too. But I might pause there and ask Mike to comment a little in terms of the sort of oil market and some of these sort of similar geopolitical shocks there which have occurred in terms of, you know, whether it's a long-term effect or something that's going to pass by more quickly.
Thank you. We'll pause there a second for a question from Senator Bishop.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know Senator Machicki could probably answer it, but I'll throw it to you first. In light of what you just said, you said you update the State Department periodically. And I can't quote you exactly what you just said, but how are we supposed to capitalize our gas on the North Slope? Where, you know, we talked about us being a sovereign, rule of law, all that, when the lending institutions in on the East Coast won't invest in Arctic projects. So I don't know if you get in that kind of detail with them, but do you have any comment on that?
Yes, and through the chair, I think the comments I would offer up. Just to clarify, I run a course for the State Department every 6 months, typical foreign service officers who are being posted around the world on natural gas. So we talk about the sort of foreign policy aspects on those occasions. But you're quite right that that there is a little bit of a mismatch between the, particularly in this foreign policy context, the development of a strategically useful resource and the willingness of the finance community to fund projects in the Arctic and specifically in Alaska. What I would say is that, you know, speaking as a consultant who's been in the industry for quite some time, the speed with which energy transition and carbon concerns have sort of affected investment decisions in the oil and gas industry has been unprecedented, I would say. And it's almost over the last 18 months, I think there's been a very marked change and a degree of caution applied by the financial community, partly because of their own shareholders and ESG concerns, and partly because they're less certain now about the long-term viability of oil and gas. But I think inevitably, and you know, some of this is material that we've covered in some of our other committee presentations. The role of oil and gas in terms of balancing global energy supply, whichever scenario you choose for the speed with which the energy transition happens, it's still material. And the major oil and gas developments that that are out there will continue to find funding. And at the end of the day, the debt market is a little bit like any other market in terms of supply and demand. And, you know, if supply is limited, then, you know, prices tend to go up. So if some of the usual players, if I can put it that way, decline to fund various projects, that there will most probably be others who are willing to do it, albeit at perhaps slightly different terms.
Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Interestingly, the access to capital has been an issue, and I think you touched upon it even last year. There was like 80 banks, 80 financial institutions that refused to do Arctic drilling, I think. Well, I think like COVID has been a global paradigm shift. I'm wondering if the war with Ukraine will be, already is, some of the same issues, and I think that we're seeing something like that today. I hope that with seeing the price volatility here, how long is it going to last? Are we going to have a paradigm shift up for a long period of time? How long will it take for an Alaskan project to come to fruition? Are there other projects ahead of us that are going to beat us to the punch? Does it even matter? Do they need all the gas? Because if Russia is no longer going to be a factor, then that whole source, that supply is gone, potentially. And maybe are we willing to risk? I mean, when do we decide for a go to no go decision on something like this?
Through the chair, I think there's some very good questions there in terms of timing. Certainly, you know, I think you've quite accurately portrayed some of the timing features of a decision around monetizing Alaskan gas. Even if things were ready to move today, we wouldn't be seeing gas leaving the North Slope for another 4 or 5 years at the very minimum. But as to whether there's a paradigm shift, my personal opinion is that I think there will be some degree of paradigm shift because there always have been concerns over the energy security of Europe, particularly in the context of Russian gas. And I think a lot of those concerns were sort of played down, and the fact is that Russia has, even today, remains a significant supplier of gas to Europe. But now it's clear that, you know, there are some very material risks around that. So I think it will do two things. It will rapidly encourage a kind of a supply diversity for natural gas. It will probably accelerate the energy transition, particularly in Europe, where people are already uneasy about the use of fossil fuels. But if it takes a while to monetize Alaskan natural gas, it takes even longer to effect any kind of meaningful transition to lower carbon forms of energy because of the massive infrastructure changes which would need to occur.
I just wanted to add a point, if possible, Mr. Chairman. I think the paradigm shift that does occur, we've seen these things before, and it is around energy security. Back in a long time ago, when there was the OPEC embargoes, it changed everybody's perspective on how to approach those supplies of crude oil, and that the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, and so forth, was not just a supplier of oil anymore. It was a strategic link to economic security. I think what's happened in the Ukraine has been kind of, people have been talking about it, but the sense was that it's Russian, you know, they'll sell the gas and everything's fine. But I think now they realize that actually energy security, you know, the short-term contracts, fungible markets, all of those things are good, but that maybe countries, nations ought to be thinking about their energy security, locking it in, almost having treaty-like relationships relating to long-term supplies of gas, which is actually full circle or back to where it was many years ago. And I don't think that's going to change. And I think it may represent an opportunity for Alaska. And it may also be the thing that makes it a little bit easier to get finance and to get all the support for it, because it's no longer an individual commercial project. It's becoming a something more strategic. And so I think that has changed, and I don't think it's going to go back to the way it was.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hear what you're saying, but with all due respect, this isn't the first time we've been here. This is just in my lifetime. This is probably the sixth time we've been here, and I don't know that folks are going to learn from that. And it's not as though we've suggested a security-based premium on energy supplies. We've been just wanting to compete, but we've been aware of this issue for many years. And I expect to see a meme out there with Putin in a set of green coveralls with his hand on a valve. I mean, he's been like a drug dealer with energy for many years, getting people addicted and then holding it over their heads and wondering when they're going to waver. And we've been here before. I don't know that they're going to learn from this. I don't know that we're going to learn from this. Mm. So it's somewhat fascinating. I mean, my philosophy is if a country can provide their own energy security, they must provide their own energy security, and everything else is secondary. It doesn't slow down the progress to alternatives and renewables. Frankly, it complements that. So it's interesting because we had some recent meetings this week. I was in New York with the top leadership from many of the lending institutions talking about this very thing. And this, my biggest frustration along the lines of what we're talking about on Western Europe, on their energy security, is how they drew this arbitrary line in Alaska. It's arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
The molecules, if they think they're protecting the Arctic, the molecules don't run up against that line and back off, right? And frankly, we have best-in-class ESG processes and have for many years, so they're actually moving themselves backward. They're moving away from best-in-class, environmental, social, and governance expectations, and rewarding by investing in other places between the Tropic of Capricorn and the Tropic of Cancer, other arbitrary lines, right? I mean, we should be moving in the opposite direction. So I'm frustrated by it, and I don't know what we learned from it. What we did learn is that arbitrary line is about Anwar and nothing else. They just didn't realize they were shutting off the rest of the region. The Anwar struggle's been going on for years. But the hypocrisy of the green extreme, frankly, this is coming from a guy that really looks forward to what renewables can do for our energy balance in the future, is working against projects like this. So I'm not suggesting a security-based premium, but you wonder if you offered something like that as a global balance, as we – this has done more to bring NATO together in a week and a half than we saw in the last 15 years, right? But you wonder if that needs to be a consideration. Sometimes if you start with a security-based premium and then you back off to just regular competitive prices, they might see it as a value they hadn't seen before. I don't have the faith you do that we're going to move in a different direction. I hope you're right, but it is time to monetize where we can and hopefully move forward for a better balance. Sure. Energy can avoid war as opposed to encourage it further, in my view. I don't know how you want to touch on that. It wasn't a question, but I've just been listening to a lot of this around the country particularly in New York City the last few days, and I'm frustrated by the lack of movement. I hope you're right.
We have a question from Senator Kawasaki.
Thanks. Sort of just to follow up on the conversation we've been having, I just noticed that BP pulled out of Russia and is abandoning its stake in Rosneft. Chevron has 15% in the Caspian Pipeline Consortium, ENI. These are all pretty familiar names to us here in Alaska. They have 50% at stake in the Blue Stream Pipeline to Turkey. Exxon also left Russia. So, are those sort of long-term signals that Senator Von Imhoff was talking about? I mean, those have to hurt when big companies like that decide to depart. Or are there smaller companies that will just take their place, I guess?
Well, that may be true, but I think it is unprecedented to have such a quick movement and on the face of it, such drastic movement. Walking away from the Rosneft interest is $25 billion. I mean, whether that actually is what ends up happening, I don't know. But I mean, it is a very dramatic signal, I think, that this is being taken extremely seriously. So if I was in the Kremlin, I would be worried. I would not have expected it to be this sharp and this dramatic. And if you have any views on that, Nick.
No, I agree with Mark, Mike, through the chair. You know, these certainly on the gas front, the problems that Russia is going to start to encounter in terms of exporting its own gas, I think with the exit of these companies, will be exacerbated quite rapidly. And I would echo Mike's comments in terms of the speed and significance of some of these events.
Brief follow-up.
Sure.
So when I actually didn't realize that ConocoPhillips had actually left completely. When they had a stake in Sakhalin, they departed after Crimea, and they haven't come back. And so is that normal for a company just to say, we're done, out, we're not playing the game anymore? Or do companies come back after a while?
Well, you know, Russia is obviously a huge economic, you know, oil and gas province and very, very important. But I think if they actually have and they do walk away from these interests, I think it's probably pretty hard for them to justify coming back in if that's what actually happens. I wonder. I mean, I was actually shocked when I heard about the Rosneft decision because it just seems like such a gigantic financial decision to make. But if it actually happens that way, I wouldn't see BP coming back.
Thank you, and we'll try and get these slides are pretty dense, and we're still close to the beginning, so if we can hold. If you have specific questions to the slides, we're just so keep in mind, we'll try and keep moving, and then at the end we can have, you know, more broad discussion. Thank you so much. Please continue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in the interest of time and perhaps focusing on some of the things we haven't yet spoken about, you know, the question is, and which has already come up today, is, well, how long would these very high spot prices be sustained? And the feature I think I would focus on this slide, which we haven't really talked about, is future years and stability. One of the major features of the US entry into the LNG space, which has been, in LNG terms, practically overnight, has been the introduction of a much more sort of entrepreneurial trading-based approach as opposed to the old style of the LNG industry, which was very much, large material contracts being agreed between two different counterparties. The very noticeable effect of that was obviously the reduction in price in sort of 2018-19 timeframe. But as more LNG carriers are moving around the world in response to price fluctuations, whether it be, you know, a lack of hydropower in Brazil or a nuclear outage in France or whatever it happens to be, the more the gas industry is able to stabilize and commoditize in the same way that oil has done. So I think in terms of the next sort of 5 to 10 years, this stabilization created by this ever-increasing flow of gas between major markets around the world will begin to introduce a degree of stability that will make price discovery a lot easier in terms of establishing a true value for the gas globally, which at the moment is very hard to do with all the different indices that apply. And would provide a more sustainable outlook for lenders, who even now I think are becoming more accommodating of gas indices rather than necessarily oil. So with that, I'll move on to the next slide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
So we've talked a lot about the volatility and the unstable nature of the LNG industry over the last couple of years. And one effect of that has been that a number of projects that otherwise were probably only months away from a financial investment decision had to basically postpone their plans during this period of particularly low prices. This graph only goes up to 2020. 2021 saw Qatar make a very significant investment in future LNG, which will emerge over the next 2 to 3 years. But But the other area of activity literally in the last few weeks and months has been on the U.S. Gulf Coast, particularly in the context of Chinese buyers who are, I think, particularly in the context of all the challenges we've just been talking about, are realizing that securing a long-term committed supply is now something they have to consider in a market where you used to be able to, you know, trade an LNG cargo practically by text and have it turn up at the regas terminal just in a matter of days. So, so in terms of the overall outlook, it seems clear that significant LNG demand will reappear by about 2027 if the current trajectory of China is continued, then I think it could occur even before that. So the question is, from a developer perspective, is there going to be a market there for the gas? Then certainly there is, and as I mentioned before, no matter what assumptions you make about the energy transition, oil and gas, and particularly LNG, remains a very robust growth market.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yes, yeah, a very brief question on the in the bold on that last page six. It says could be the last chance to monetize the substantial gas resource in a traditional manner. What's meant by that, and what's a traditional manner?
Mr. Chairman, essentially, thank you for your questions. I'm glad you asked for that clarification. So I think. First of all, it's clear that the gas resources in Alaska has the potential to be monetized in many, many different ways. The current concept, if you like, in terms of production on the North Slope, removing the CO2 pipeline, liquefaction, and so forth, that looks increasingly like a relatively high-cost solution in today's world, particularly with the advent of technology. And particularly as the carbon intensity of LNG starts to become more and more important, that too could represent a drawback in terms of selling that gas and providing the investment. So in terms of talking about monetizing gas in a traditional manner, obviously, everyone on the committee will be well aware that with the changing climatic conditions on the North Slope, the potential for an ice-breaking type LNG fleet to pick up LNG directly from the North Slope is certainly one project which could be argued is less traditional. And then, of course, as we turn the clock forward and we get deeper and deeper into the energy transition, and as the global price placed on carbon becomes higher and higher, then you've got technologies like blue hydrogen, blue ammonia, for which the North Slope arguably is very well positioned, where you basically produce hydrogen or ammonia on the North Slope, sequester the carbon in an appropriate geological horizon, and produce what effectively would be a zero carbon fuel using the gas. So obviously, those are ideas which are sort of well down the road. But nevertheless, probably in the context of the Alaskan economy, warrant, quite a significant investigation, I would say.
Sure. Yes, Senator Bishop.
I've been wanting to make this comment for 2 days. Just, I'm not going to say the energy market's fickle, but it's fickle. And going back to 2010 when we were looking at building a pipeline to Alberta to go to the continental United States, we were building import terminals on the Gulf Coast. And so what did we do with those import terminals? We made them export terminals. So that's just how fast the market can change. Senator Machicki.
Kind of a little bit of a follow-up to the Senator Kawasaki's question. But so I just been in the industry for a long time, and we would see these, you know, 30 or 40 announcements that result in an export terminal or two. But my question is more related to this project on the balance from oversupply to or undersupply to oversupply. How does Gaffney Klein evaluate the risk on assumed supply availability that can change somewhat dramatically through the life of from FID to construction? How do you evaluate that risk?
Thank you. And through the chair, you know, my comments, I think, would be that as a independent energy consultant, we evaluate on a continuing basis, most of the sort of significant gas developments around the world. We advise other clients on a variety of projects, which in itself provides a learning opportunity and provides insights into what the industry is doing. So in the context of evaluating the supply risk, because, you know, when we do due diligence for an LNG project, it's usually the top question in terms of, well, will this or is this project viable in terms of the selling price and will it remain so? So we typically do a comparative study of both existing and potential LNG. The example Senator Bishop just gave where we had this extraordinary revolution in technology, which completely reversed many of the sort of underlying assumptions in the Lower 48. You know, that's one of those black swan events which I don't think we would have been able to predict years in advance, albeit you can recognize it while it's happening. But certainly. You know, LNG projects are, to some extent, you know, relatively simple in concept. You've got an upstream development for which the sort of wellhead break-even can be usually relatively well established. You've got a liquefaction plant, which is, you know, either being built on the Gulf Coast with a trained and available workforce, or it's being built by workers in a construction camp somewhere, which obviously very different approaches. And then the other, the remaining part of the value chain with the ships and the regas is, again, relatively easy to quantify. So, of course, it all hinges on the resource and its quality, but ultimately that would be the kind of analysis that we do.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So, thank you. New window of opportunity. However, AK LNG will require a very large capital investment, and the state should weigh the risks carefully. I mean, so the question is this very large capital investment, is Alaska, as in the state of Alaska, going to pay for this? Or is this going to be China? Or is this going to be Exxon or combination thereof? So how do we kind of decide who's going to pay and what's the best strategy? Mm-hmm. What are other places do? And then from there, of course, we've got to figure out, well, how much is that very large capital investment? Has it gone up? Has it gone down in the last few years? And I know that there was a Wood Mackenzie report done. And is that are those numbers accurate? So I'm asking quite a bit. And I don't know if your subsequent slides answer some of that.
Mr. Chairman, I may wait until we get to the specific cost slide to deal with the question about the current cost estimate. And yes, I definitely have some comments on that. But in terms of your more general remarks about who pays, the unique feature of Alaska within the United States is that its economy is so inextricably linked with its oil and gas resources. So in that sense, you could argue that the role of the government, the state government, in monetizing oil and gas resources is different and perhaps more akin to perhaps even a Middle Eastern country or, you know, a nation where the economy is very tightly linked. So whereas in Texas, for example, Texas, Louisiana, you've got a whole array of privately sponsored and funded LNG projects. Here in Alaska, you could argue that the kind of model used elsewhere in the world, which involves a much higher degree of state involvement, you know, could be appropriate. I mean, that's clearly a question which, you know, is for you to evaluate and decide on. But in my view, Alaska is a little bit different from that point of view, and therefore some different degree of state involvement might be appropriate and might help to get the project launched. And one of my other slides deals with the role that the state might play in doing that, so perhaps we'll pause for that.
Good. Please continue then.
So again, I think in the interest of time, we can probably go over a number of these features, you know, in that they've come up in the context of some of the previous questioning. The ones I'd probably pause on would be, you know, the feed gas. Clearly, you have an array of very competent upstream providers in the state operating the very significant assets which would form the basis for the LNG scheme. You know, the typical makeup of an LNG project would typically involve one of those significant upstream stakeholders. That's certainly been the case in previous projects. It's not necessarily the case at the moment, but forming that kind of partnership with the feed gas producer and establishing a project structure which creates alignment right the way along the value chain, for me, is perhaps the most important thing. I would say in my career before Gap and Klein, I was probably involved in four or five major LNG projects, and it is this question of alignment and sort of degree of trust between stakeholders, which is probably the feature which accelerates development most quickly. So, you know, that's an interesting observation on the sort of feed gas side. It also relates to the project structure, where, you know, typically, you know, there are three broad concepts normally used for LNG. One is a fully integrated project, which ultimately was what was envisaged in the early days after Senate Bill 138. Another is a merchant project, which is where you buy the gas from the producer and then sell it on into the LNG market, which I think has been considered also in the last few years. And the third one is a tolling structure, where the pipeline and liquefaction is treated separately as an infrastructure project which operates under a tariff. And again, you know, when we consider the role of the Alaskan government, a tolling type structure can often lend itself to you know, host government involvement. So the project structure is definitely an area to look at. So I think, you know, we've talked about commoditization and the way in which the LNG market is moving. And while we think about the role of an IOC or a gas producer, one of the other facets of de-risking a project is what's usually termed equity marketing, where, and this would apply in Mozambique, for example, Senegal, and many of the sort of current LNG projects where the project developers themselves would sign on for an LNG purchase contract, therefore providing the basis for the finance. So, the way in which that is approached, will have a significance as well. So, moving on and talking a little bit more about the feed gas, I mean, clearly, Prudhoe Bay in particular, I've heard it said many times that there can be no doubt that the gas is there because it's been produced several times already and reinjected. And, that says a lot about the way the field has been operated. From my understanding, it's approaching a kind of blowdown phase where monetizing the gas will become more and more important. But ultimately, a lot of the capital investment has been made and paid for through oil revenues. And, obviously, there is the potential for a much lower cost of gas as a result, depending on the upstream economics and the additional capital required. So I think, this question of the upstream price, it's been talked about quite extensively with the upstream producers. It was discussed while there were upstream producers in the project. But certainly, there should be a very strong case to produce natural gas from the North Slope at a relatively low input cost. So, on the slide here, slide 9, it's a good opportunity to talk about the cost base of the project. There are two features, I think, which warrant a discussion. The first is the basic cost of the infrastructure in terms of capital investment up front. I know AGDC have done some work on this, and I've read the report that WoodMac have produced. I note that the assumptions in the WoodMac report come from AGDC, so it's not possible really to tell from the report, what the basis of some of those numbers were. I noticed that the cost of the gas processing plant, the pipeline, remain, a little bit less than was envisaged a few years ago, but the cost for the liquefaction plant came down quite significantly. At the moment, I'm not sure when those estimates would have been made, but at the moment, with the cost of steel and the cost headwinds that are facing most oil and gas developments, it's a cost reduction from a 2015 number or thereabouts in the current steel market seems a challenge. And I'd point, for example, to the Trans Mountain pipeline, the oil pipeline in Canada, which started out with similar cost, similar budget to the gas line from North Slope down to Cook Inlet, but has since inflated quite significantly, and I think is now running at well over double the original cost. So that is a sort of snapshot and provides a kind of context in terms of the current market.
Real quickly, we have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you. So that was actually one of my questions, is how does one estimate what a gas liquefaction facility needed up on Prudhoe Bay would cost? And you sort of answered that if you said Alberta, I believe.
So, in Alberta and British Columbia, again, focusing on Canada a few hundred miles south, LNG Canada is probably a very good metric to use. I mean, with that project, I think based on public domain figures, that was looking at a sort of 40 to 50% cost disadvantage compared to the Gulf Coast, for example, which is fully understandable given the kind of seasonal building and the remoteness of the facility. They too are building a gas pipeline across the Rockies, which has certainly encountered some headwinds. But in terms of how you would estimate that, I mean, typically you would have a FEED study carried out, front-end engineering design, and you would then take that to an EPC company who would provide an estimate. Within the LNG community, the fashion has been to secure fixed price contracts or certainly limited price variation contracts with the EPC contractors to address some of the cost inflation issues. And certainly for the Gulf Coast, the degree of sort of capital efficiency applied to those EPC contracts and executing them has actually proven very effective.
Thank you.
So I might just, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I may just add some commentary to this as well in the context of the WoodMac report and the AGDC numbers, which is that I think about two-thirds or three-quarters of the cost reduction which has been set out in that report arises from purely financing issues. So I think it's envisaged that, for example, the project would benefit from a federal loan guarantee. The project would be structured in a way to de-risk the infrastructure element. And as such, you know, the costs would come down quite significantly. So that element of the cost reduction, I've looked at the logic in the WoodMac report. I certainly have no issue with the maths and the way they derived their assumptions. But I think in terms of those financing arrangements, it would be necessary to sort of dig into how the project was likely to be structured and therefore what some of the benefits are. And I think, Mike, this is a feature that you've had some experience of, to some sort of de-risking through finance.
Yeah, I guess my reaction to it was that it may be possible to use these, you know, financial mechanisms to reduce the cost, but I would like to understand how it relates to these assumptions have kind of developed a kind of a bankability case for the project. I mean, to me, to talk about reducing the cost without having a clearer sense of whether it's a bankable project was my reaction to it. And there may be very good explanations for it, but I think there's a lot more that needs to be looked at to understand that.
Thank you. And you touched on it, but could you please maybe again just briefly explain maybe the specific differences in the costs and liquefaction here compared to the Gulf Coast or Canada? What are the key factors? It seems like a pretty big difference to me.
As I say, there are some differences in terms of what we had assumed would be sort of generally speaking typical of an LNG facility in this part of the world, being advised also by some of the costs which were being discussed back in 2015 and so on. So I think in terms of the differences, the LNG facility itself had a reduction, I think, of about 20%. The pipeline, I think, might even have been slightly higher than we had, and the gas treatment plant was a little lower. So the significant difference was with the liquefaction plant in terms of what we would have adopted as a sort of generic figure based on LNG Canada and perhaps some of the other typical projects. But just to reiterate, I think the very significant difference, which is exhibited on this bar chart, or would be, is this question of financing. It is a very material feature. And for example, if you look at the very first of the LNG projects on the Gulf Coast that reversed itself and became an exporting terminal, they, I think, were breaking relatively new ground. The finance, the debt was relatively expensive in the sense that people weren't that comfortable with the risk. And that resulted in a tolling tariff of over $3 an MMBTU. If you look at where things stand today, the tolling tariffs typically for some of these new terminals can be as little as $2 or slightly less than $2. Some of that is capital efficiency, but almost all of it is the effect of a much, much lower cost of debt and a much greater willingness of people to lend. So in summary, I think it is this question of how the project is financed, how it's de-risked to the point where the cost of debt is very low indeed, and how that fits in with the LNG sales and the balance sheets, which are ultimately at the end of the supply chain.
Thank you.
I think the next slide talks about financing.
Perfect.
I think you want to get through this, but I'll come back for you.
In your hole. Perfect. Please continue.
Okay. And so I think, again, on this slide, we have talked about quite a bit of this before. We've talked about, we've returned many times to this question of the the willingness of established financial players to lend to even a gas project, let alone a gas project that's in a sensitive area like this. The other feature which may give rise to some concerns is the CO2 handling and the fact that there is such a significant presence of CO2 in the gas, potentially, depending on where it comes from. And the resulting energy intensity that goes with that. So I think, in terms of financing, though, LNG still attracts a kind of a high level, a sort of high grade of financial participant. Most of the, there are still some very material banking groups who will continue to support LNG, and it's attracting some of those large players, which would be, I think, of key importance to Alaska going forward. And actually, just in terms of some of the specifics, it's interesting that one or two of the pension funds. And the question came up earlier today about Canada, for example. Now, obviously, Canada is a resource-oriented country, and as a result, I think some of their pension funds continue to be more amenable to resource-type investments. And I just use that as an example that there are still entities interested. So, again, just in the interest of time, I'll go through this slide quite quickly. This question of selling LNG in an increasingly carbon-orientated world, as I've mentioned, the North Slope gas has a high CO2 content, which may add to some of the concerns and difficulties, but may also represent an opportunity, certainly for any type of carbon capture. There's already a fairly significant federal tax credit which could go up, and particularly if it could form part of a lower carbon type project. There are other allowances and credits available too. So I think, you know, clearly you'll be well aware on this committee of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the implications that has for Alaska and its natural resource development. And as you know, there are some additional measures being considered in Washington, which, you know, could potentially have a beneficial effect too, should they be passed. So perhaps to hesitate on this slide for a little bit, we talked about the role of the Alaskan government in facilitating monetization of the gas. We've talked about fiscal incentives in some of the other committee meetings that we've been involved with, and those materials are obviously available. And, you know, in the context of that, clearly providing an environment that makes it profitable for both the resource holder and the state to produce gas to go into the LNG project, you know, it's clearly kind of a prerequisite. The next feature where the state could potentially involve itself in facilitation of the project would be, for example, carbon capture and sequestration. I know there are initiatives being looked at here already, but I'll give you an example of Freeport LNG in Texas. They're reducing the carbon footprint of their gas by capturing the CO2 from the gas treatment plant as it goes in and sequestering it geologically. They're claiming the $50 credit, obviously, for doing that. So it's not only helping the marketability of their LNG, but it's also providing a profitable stream of revenue. So, you know, as you look at, you know, the North Slope and how the gas gets treated, ways to integrate those types of schemes, you know, would work well. So in terms of, you know, project and financial structuring, I've spoken about the very significant impact of lowering the risk profile of the project has on the availability and cost of finance on what would effectively be of the order of a $40 billion investment. So, you know, coming back to perhaps Senator von Imhoff's questions earlier on, the role that the state takes in that, whether it involves direct investment, whether it involves some kind of guarantee or support or other mechanism which would de-risk the project for investors and participants, you know, that again is a very powerful tool that's available to the state in bringing a scheme on board. And again, staying with the you know, low carbon picture, certainly even within the US, a premium payable for what's typically termed clean gas, which is gas that's produced with low water, with low energy input. You know, this idea that there is a premium payable for gas of that sort is definitely a feature which is catching on, and again would probably require some kind of state support. The particular opportunity in Alaska, of course, is, for example, Fairbanks as well, where, you know, use of that gas in Fairbanks would, you know, lower the heating costs and generation costs of that part of the state quite significantly, again, potentially with state help.
Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you. And I guess you've talked about state support, and I notice in this slide that the two things that stick out at me are upstream incentives designed to lower the gas price at the wellhead, and then something about lower exploration production tax revenues being offset by employment. And neither of those aligns well with the Alaska's fiscal regime today, right? We are the resource owner. Lower prices for the resource are not necessarily in the owner's interests, and there is no offset from enhanced employment around the state. Can you talk to us about how those structures might, how those recommendations might be made to work with Alaska's fiscal regime, or whether Alaska's fiscal regime needs to change to make those incentives possible?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the, and Senator Kuehl for the question. I think I may revert to Mike shortly in terms of some of the broader fiscal arrangements. But one of the features of LNG is this and the long-term nature of it. And so one could imagine an LNG specific mechanism, which, for example, provides for a faster payback on investment exchanged for higher state revenues in the longer term, mechanisms like that. And I think it's worth mentioning, we haven't really talked about it in the presentation, but most, I would say the majority of LNG projects around the world typically don't rely on existing legislation for them to go ahead. There's usually some form of enabling legislation, which very often is LNG specific and relates just to the project being looked at. And so, again, in the context of Alaska, a piece of enabling legislation which encompasses, many of the features that we've talked about today, but is aimed at providing an appropriate investment case for the project, I think could warrant being looked at. But with that, perhaps, Mike, you'd like to comment on some of the more general...
On the fiscal incentives upstream. Well, you do see in many jurisdictions around the world that the states are quite proactive in supporting upstream operations, especially in the down periods. So, for instance, during the 2020 period, Norway essentially de-risked exploration drilling by covering rebating those costs on an annual basis. Those kinds of things could make a big difference, especially in a down market. There can also be other tax-type incentives for wells, and I believe you do have some of those in Alaska already, I believe. So all of those kinds of things can support the activities. I don't think there's any magic bullet to it to reduce the break-even costs, but all of those things can help. And there's many, I think, many different types of mechanisms that could be considered.
Senator Machicki.
Can I put that another way, and maybe you can help if you agree with me? I think what you pointed out is the few levers that the state can pull that would improve the economics of the project, right? We can't control the inflation of carbon steel products. We can't control the design and development. We can't control the transportation costs, but the state has a couple of levers, and that might be stability at the wellhead price. It might be using infrastructure dollars in the production of ammonia and hydrogen production, which you didn't list, but that might be some other areas. You simply pointed out levers that the only levers that the state can control. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. I mean, there's many things that the state can't do anything about. The resource potential is the resource potential. Some of the kind of regulatory issues are federal, and there's not much you can do about it. But there are, the incentives to or support for different kinds of activities that you presumably have some ability to do that. And creating a fiscally stable environment, that is important too. Those are the things you have control over, and yes, and I think it can make a difference.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let's move on to our concluding slide. So I think this slide summarizes a lot of the really good discussion that we've had with the committee today. The first bullet point on the slide is the one that we just addressed, which is to foster an environment that will minimize the wellhead break-even cost, and provide an environment where a sustainable gas price can be developed. The second one I've touched on a few times, which is this question of potentially a creative but certainly a stable project structure, which from my point of view is probably the most important feature of any LNG project and can save years of pre-project discussion while the different parties become aligned. So in this case, it's a question of aligning the interests of the state, the gas producers, and obviously those folks who are lending to the project. We've talked about the federal policies now, which are coming into focus and which can be used to potentially quite materially improve the economics of the project, particularly in the context of a loan guarantee and the resulting lower finance that would result from that. And again, not wanting to overdo the point, but in order to compete in today's gas world, the project would need to have robust carbon credentials of some sort. It's not to say that it would need to be cutting edge, but from the point of view of customers and lenders, it would have to have a robust emission strategy to accompany the development of the project. So the final point, which again we've touched on, is to look at ways to leverage various types of financing that could be available, which would obviously improve the economics of the project. So with that, I think that concludes our slide presentation. I'm very happy to take questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Von Imhoff?
I just want to say thank you very much for coming all the way from London, I think, to here. And it was very thorough. You've been very delightful to work with. I appreciate it. Thank you for answering our questions. Hopefully we can at least keep in touch in the near future as the session progresses. Some things may crop up. So just thank you for being here today and showing up in person.
Thank you.
Senator Marchicki.
Mr. Chairman, what would you like to get done today? You're going to introduce the resolution. Do we plan on moving that today?
If we can.
Okay. And we're going to, folks can stay over for a little bit for that discussion.
If that's all right with the committee, we'll get done what we can.
I had a quick one, then, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I see Russia. I mean, Sakhalin's brownfield, but Yamal is not, but certainly not under this inflation structure. And you have kind of a constant line with your liquefaction for Russia LNG and Alaska LNG. Clearly, our disadvantage is pipeline length and probably some regulation issues, which is also a plus. But why is your seems like we have need for more of a contingency today than we ever have. You didn't include that in this breakdown on page 9.
Page 9.
Would you say there's some risk that's not covered? And I understand the point to get in the $7 to $9 range to compete with the other projects, but that's going to be tougher today than ever.
In the context of the construction cost inflation, which we talked about, it is a very tough challenge. All I would say is that there are, as we've noted, so many other very strong features of the project in terms of the size and quality of the resource and the nature of the host government, if I put it that way. There is definitely an avenue to be pursued around the financing costs, particularly with some of the federal policy, which is now applicable. But it would be wrong, I think, to characterize those cost challenges as being easy to address.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions? Well, speaking of this slide, I want to thank you as well. It's been a pleasure to work with you. And I think earlier I said liquefaction, and you instinctively knew I meant liquefaction. I appreciate that. And I want to thank our LB&A chair. Thank you for making this possible. We've appreciated working with you again. It's my intent that today's hearing is part of a larger discussion about oil and gas here in Alaska, that we continue our conversation. If members would like, we can try and have Gaffney Klein respond in writing or perhaps in future meetings via Teams. So thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been a privilege to be here and to work with you.
Yeah, I'd like to offer my thanks as well, particularly given my previous involvement with the state. It's just such a privilege to come back.
We feel the same. We'll take a brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. Next, we're going to bring up SJR 24, end import of oil and gas from Russia. I would like to thank members for working with our office to improve this resolution. I think it just goes to show that protecting democracy and democratic ideals abroad is a very bipartisan issue. And Americans and Alaskans can stand together to do what's right. So before we begin, and with members' consent, I would like to adopt a committee substitute as our working document and then begin to discuss the resolution. I believe there's a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Resources Committee adopt the CS for Senate Joint Resolution 24. It's version 32LS1619/B as in Bethel as our working document.
Thank you, Senator Keel. I'll object quickly for the purposes of discussion. As a committee, we work together on this resolution. This version of the bill makes a few small but very important changes to help strengthen this message in the resolution. And I believe everybody understands the changes. If we'd like, we could go through them one by one. Okay, we all understand the changes. So with that, I'll remove my objection. Are there any further objections to adopting the CS for SJR 24 version B as our working document? All right, seeing none, version B is adopted as our working document. All right, I'm going to start out with a few comments that I believe that I was clear in my speech on the floor today, but just wanted to reiterate the importance of shifting away from our dependence on oil and minerals produced in authoritarian and totalitarian countries with no regard for environmental or public safety, and with no regards for human life, as well as clearly seen the last week in Ukraine. What this resolution does, I'll just read the be it resolves. I believe we may have one additional amendment. The be it resolves. Number one, be it resolved that Alaska State Legislature urges President Biden's administration and the United States Congress to allow the nation to use the oil and gas resources currently available in the state of Alaska to replace imported oil from the Russian Federation, and be it further resolved that the Alaska State Legislature urges President Biden's administration and the United States Congress to unleash national production in this state and other energy-producing states to fortify the economy and security of the nation. All right, is there any further discussion? Questions? All right, we have no invited testimony. We're going to open public testimony. Public testimony on SJR 24 is now open. Are there any members in the room who would like to testify? All right, seeing none. Are there any members online, members of the public, who would like to testify? We have Mike Coons from Palmer. Mike, if you could put yourself on the record and give us 2 minutes.
Hi, I'm hoping you can hear me because I have a real person phone sometimes. My name is Mike Coons. I'm speaking for myself. I support SJR 24. Russia's tyrant and dictator Vladimir Putin mercilessly attacked the people of Ukraine. Two major reasons: power and oil. Yes, snowflakes and their parents who opposed Desert Storm in the Second World War in Iraq, it was about oil as well. Oil to be taken by tyrants and dictators. This is different, however. Dictator tyrant is Putin. The lone good guy is Ukraine President Zelensky. May add Boris Johnson from the UK. Sure, the EU so-called leadership is being hard calling this crime into support of Ukraine. The UN totally is worthless. At least Hungary, Romania, and Poland are taking in refugees. A note to the above is my total silence of Let's Go Brandon. As I write this at 3 p.m., headline from Fox News, quote, Biden administration digs in against sanctions of Russia oil as more Americans demand action, gas surges. We, Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, North and South Dakota, Iowa, Kansas, the breadbasket, the Rust Belt, the South and the Southwest, I'll stand for the Ukraine and against the tyrant and Marxist weakling, Let's Go Brandon. These two are in each of their own way a danger to American freedoms and world domination, much less nuclear showdown. With LGB doing standing down to Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. God help us all. God bless America, and God help us to defeat evil and weakness the evil which is designed to decide. So evil shall reign. Khrushchev said we would bury ourselves. To allow that to happen, we stand as patriots against evil. are scared to fight. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, and thanks for waiting throughout the committee for your testimony. We appreciate it today. Is there anyone else online who would like to testify? All right, seeing none, we're going to close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed on Senate Joint Resolution 24. Are there amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I move conceptual amendment number one.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
So your speech today was excellent. This is very well written. You pointed out the environmental superiority of Alaska production, only we sort of forgot to put it in this in this amazing resolution. So I move conceptual amendment number one, and that is which I did, and you objected. So it would do this. What I'll do is explain what happens here, and then I'll read it out, if that's okay. On page 2, line 22, the word this would be stricken out and replaced with the word a. After state, it would say, in a state, it would say, recognized as a global leader in best-in-class environmental, social, and governance, ESG, in parentheses, performance, comma, and the word that would be added before the word can. So if you'd like me to read that in its entirety, I'd be happy to do that.
If you could read that whereas, just so we get that on the record, I'd appreciate that, Senator Machiki.
So if the conceptual amendment is passed, it would say on line 21, whereas because development sites around Alaska hold the potential of billions of barrels of oil and gas produced in a state, recognized as a global leader in best-in-class environmental, social, and governance, parentheses, ESG, performance that can fill the void left from stopping Russian Federation imports, thereby eliminating national dependence on authoritarian energy producers abroad.
Thank you, Senator Machiki. In discussion, I believe that that is a friendly amendment. I think it strengthens the resolution. Is there other discussion? All right. With that, I will remove my objection. Is there any further objections to conceptual amendment number one? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number one passes. Is there further discussion? All right. Seeing no further discussion, is there a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for Senate Resolution Number 24, Resources Version 32-LS1619/B, as conceptually amended, be moved from committee with attached committee and individual recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Are there any objections? All right. Seeing none. The motion to move SJR 24 as described from committee passes. Thank you very, very much for your patience, to the committee members for your attention today. Thank you to Gaffney Klein for being here to give their presentation. Thank you to staff and LIO staff and Senate pages who helped out with the committee today. Our next regularly scheduled committee meeting will be Wednesday, March 9th. Monday, March 7th has been canceled. We will have a presentation on SB 223, confidentiality of animal records. Thank you again. This meeting is adjourned at 5:11.